This is WRIR's election special interview with Jim Nachman, candidate opposite Eric Cantor for the U.S. House of Representatives seat in the 7th District of Virginia. We invited Eric Cantor, whose secretary responded with, quote, "We can't help you this year." So, unlike WRVA and Fox News, we have gone out of our way ahead of this interview to offer opportunity for dialogue. Okay, welcome to special election coverage by WRIRLP in Richmond, Virginia. We have with us today Jim Nachman, who is the 7th District candidate for the Federal House of Representatives in Virginia. We have invited Eric Cantor, but his secretary informed us that they could not help us this year, was the exact quote. Interesting way of putting it. That's too bad, so sad, because I think it would have been very interesting to get the interaction of two people, not to mention an audience that rarely gets a chance to have their thoughts reflected upon. So, that being said, let's go ahead and get started then. I noticed on your website you mentioned that your ancestry is Russian, and I'm just curious. We have a lot of people who are interested in the arts, and Gallery 5 is putting on a whole series of shows, including choir singers on Friday. From Russia, they're having Russian photographs. Do you have any part of that?
I don't have any part of that as far as that exposition is concerned. My grandfather, and let me just comment on Eric Cantor not being here. I have challenged Eric Cantor to debate me, and through a number of different sources, the League of Women Voters, through Congregation Or Atid Temple, and through other bar associations, and of course he refuses to debate me. I would love to debate him. I think it's a disservice to the voters in the 7th Congressional District not to have this interaction of views. I know when I announced my candidacy, Eric Cantor said that he was looking forward to discussing the issues. I don't know how we can discuss the issues unless he's willing to have sort of an interactive debate with me.
Wow, if I were evangelical, I might say he was bearing false witness.
Well, perhaps.
Right, that's between him and his.
I just wish that Eric would quit hiding, and I wish that he would be man enough to come out and meet me head on. I would I'd love to ask him some questions, and I'm sure that the voters in the 7th Congressional District would be enthralled to hear what answers he may have to some of the important issues we have facing us in this country today.
Oh, I had some great questions lined up from his past in high school, just for fun.
Right.
So, you know, we like to have people with a wide variety of backgrounds. That's the whole point of radio for the rest of us.
It's right.
All those people that are citizens. They are a part of the creation of our culture and our citizenry and our civilization. But they're not mainstream.
Right.
But that doesn't mean they're not important. And that's the point of having candidates come in and have different voices that they react to. And that's another reason I really wish Cantor, as you said, would not cut and run and come out for a conversation.
Getting back to my ancestry, since you asked about that. Yes, my dad was sort of the first generation here, and his brothers and sisters, my grandpa on my dad's side, came from Russia. And through Ellis Island, like a lot of people, I mean, he came here with the equivalent of, I think, a nickel in his pocket and an apple, and that's it. And he ended up running the general store in Marshall, Virginia, and later on in Middleburg, Virginia, an Ackman store. And a lot of, you know, my uncle, one of my uncles was a judge. My dad was an orthopedic surgeon. My aunt worked for the Rouse Corporation in Baltimore, and they were very good people, very accomplished people, and I just hope that I can aspire to be as good a man as my dad was, because for those of the people here in Richmond that knew him, Dr. Nachman did a lot of good for a lot of people mended a lot of bones, and was a good man in the community. My mom came here from Scotland, and she was a nurse, so it was sort of like General Hospital between my mom and my dad. And it's interesting, because my mom converted to Judaism, And so I've kind of had the best of both worlds. You know, of course, I was raised Jewish and, you know, went to Hebrew school and Sunday school and was bar mitzvahed and confirmed. But on my mom's side, I also got to see, you know, the other side through the Christian religion. And, you know, we would go to Scotland, and my mom had a house in Scotland where my grandmother lived in a little fishing village called Crail, about 12 miles south of St. Andrews in Fife, Scotland. And we'd go over there for summers and during Christmas. And so I used to go to midnight mass with my grandmother in Crail, Scotland. So I've kind of had the benefit of seeing the best of both worlds and the best of both cultures. And I think that that has been a good thing, you know, as far as my upbringing is concerned.
Does your grandfather have any great anecdotes, stories of life in a dictatorship that might send any chills up anyone's spine these days?
You know, he didn't really talk about that very much.
Right.
You know, I know he'd like to have a shot of whiskey before dinner, and he liked pumpernickel bread, and, you know, he used to think this was funny. He used to say, well, you eat this 100 years and you'll live long. He used to think that was real funny, so... And we go, okay, yeah, right, Grandpa. So,
if I get to eat bread for 100 years,
right.
Yes, I would be living long.
Exactly. So, but he was a very hardworking man, a lot of people talk about him. They still remember Nachman's store in Middleburg. It was a general store, and that's where people shopped. And when I go to that part of the country, and even in the 7th Congressional District, when I go up to Page and Rappahannock County, there's a lot of people up there who used to shop there when they were kids. And also my cousins, I think, ran Nachman's store in Herndon, Virginia. My cousins here in Richmond ran Jefferson Clothing, and that was owned by the Nachmans, Larry Nachman and Ken and John and, of course, Larry's wife, Rosalie. I don't know if you all remember these commercials about Jefferson Clothing and Rosalie Nachman with that sort of a southern accent talking about Jefferson and Lady Jefferson and all that. So, interesting family. My wife, Kelly, jokes that, you know, between the Nachmans, if you haven't, you know, had a bone set or been clothed by some Nachman in at some time in Richmond, Virginia, well, then you really haven't lived here that long, so.
So you're a been here, not a came here.
I was born at MCV and grew up in Henrico County. Went to Tucco Elementary, Tucco Junior High, Douglas Freeman. After that, I went to University of Miami for a couple of years and transferred to the University of Virginia. I went to law school for a while in Alabama, believe it or not, and then absolutely hated it. But then got into University of Richmond Law School and finished there. So that's the extent of my education. I had a few courses that I took in graduate school in the political science and maybe public administration. I'm a native, lived here, and understand the history and the politics of this area, and have made a lot of friends, and I'm glad to call Richmond my home, sure.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting then that you are relatively progressive and from a conservative, and you went to law school in Alabama, and yet here comes George Allen from California,
right,
with the cowboy costume, and you're not wearing anything notably Virginia-esque in your clothing. So
Douglas Freeman was not the most enlightened high school. I mean, I'm glad I went there, and I went to the Douglas Freeman Patrick Henry High School game. It was homecoming this past, I guess it was Friday night, and saw a lot of people there that I went to school with. But you know, back when I went to Douglas Freeman, they played Dixie and had rebel flags and all that. And you know, obviously they don't have that anymore. But it was part of Douglas Freeman back when I went to school there, and I remember at pep rallies when they played Dixie, African Americans would walk out in protest, you know, unfortunately a lot of people went like, oh well, you know, they just didn't really understand why they were doing that, why they didn't accept that,
right?
So things have changed, and I think in a lot of respects for the better.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of changes, MTBE I saw on your website. I know that for here in Richmond, from my end of things, that the news reports on the pollution of MTBE was carried on Living on Earth, which was then very shortly after that canceled. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the other radio station that had Living on Earth had a chairman who was the public relations director of a fuel additive company that made them, otherwise known back then as Ethyl Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
So the confluence of the cancellation just seemed kind of, you know, shall we say, well, you know how it goes with Abu Ghraib and things.
Right.
Just kind of obvious. And so that was one of the key reasons that we actually started what was then Radio Free Richmond effort became WRIR. So it was interesting to see that. And I was wondering if you could give us any updates on what's going on with MTBE these days.
You know, I don't really have any updates. One of the reasons that I mentioned that on my website is because of Eric Cantor's vote on that. I mean, here mm-hmm. are communities bringing lawsuits, and he's basically blocking those lawsuits and blocking these people's ability to get compensated for basically poisoning them. And I just can't imagine why somebody who is representing the people would not protect the people. I think I do understand why he voted the way he did, because he basically represents the big corporate interests, and it's all about the money in Washington. It's all about who's given him political contributions. Unfortunately, that is the system in Washington. It's more about the lobbyists and about getting reelected than it is about representing the people. You have 38,000 registered lobbyists in Washington. I believe that number has doubled in the last 2 or 3 years. They're all trying to influence every member of the House, about 435 House members. And, you know, in Eric Cantor's case, and I think in a lot of these legislators' cases, there's a direct correlation between the way they vote and the money that they receive. And you can go to Project Vote Smart and see how people vote, how Eric Cantor votes. You can go to opensecrets.org and see where he's getting his money. And there's just, doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that, well, you know, he's voting the way he's voting because of the big money that he's receiving from big oil, from pharmaceutical companies, and all the interests that are basically not really looking out for the interests of the people. More, it's more about profit.
So if I hear you correctly, you know, Republicans, I often hear them say that they want government off our back and they want the, you know, people's private property to be protected. So here are the wells of private people or organizations such mm-hmm. as a municipality that have received damage, and you're saying Eric Cantor is actually blocking their effort to receive compensation for damage to their private property.
Well, they, you know, not allowing them to bring those sort of lawsuits. And you know, I'm a lawyer too, and I think that, you know, if somebody has been damaged and they want to bring a lawsuit, and obviously they have to prove that they have been damaged and that the damage is the proximate cause of their injuries, et cetera. They ought to be able to do that. And they ought to be, I mean, that is our judicial system. You ought to be able to have a jury. You ought to be able to have an opportunity to prove that. Obviously, it's a civil standard. It's by a preponderance of the evidence, or it's more likely than not than what you're alleging has occurred. And, you know, if there has been some damage caused by these carcinogens and people can prove that it's actually causing their injuries, then they ought to be able to bring a lawsuit to be compensated for the wrongs that have been done to them. And I don't understand why anybody would block their ability to do that.
What do other conservative activists say about that?
They don't really talk about that. They talk about their agenda. They talk about things that obviously they care about, that they think is more important. And that's the thing about some conservatives. They just don't really want to talk about some of these issues. They want to talk about, you know, you mentioned they want to get government off your back. They want limited government, but yet they talk out both sides of their mouth. They're hypocrites because it's okay for government to be involved in the most personal aspects of your life, like the Terri Schiavo case, you know, getting involved in a family decision as to whether or not to basically pull the plug on somebody who is not really functioning anymore. I mean, I think this is a family decision and something that government should not be involved in. They want to tell you what you can do or not do in your bedroom. You know, what two consenting adults want to do. It doesn't make any sense to me that they want to do these things, but yet they talk about getting government off your back. I mean, they want to get off government off your back in certain respects, in other respects they want to absolutely get on your back. So I guess it just depends on what issue you're talking about. And limited government, I think they talk about that because it sounds good, because government is so unpopular now. People are distrustful of government, and I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing. I mean, I think our founding fathers wanted us to be suspicious of government, wanted us to be ever vigilant, to be watchdogs, to watch how our money is being spent. And I think that that's actually a great idea. But I think that, and I think that people are just sort of inherently distrustful of government, and I don't blame them, because what's going on now in Washington, they have every right to be distrustful and suspicious of their legislators. It's unfortunate, because I think that people in Congress used to be sort of revered and sort of role models, and unfortunately, I think a lot of them have been corrupted, and they are. And I think a lot of people just don't really respect them anymore, because they just have become reactionaries. They're good at giving you a nice sound bite, a nice press release, but they don't really do anything proactive anymore. And they talk in terms of broad themes, but they never really follow through on the things that they talk about.
This is WRIR's election special interview with Jim Nachman, candidate opposite Eric Cantor for the U.S. House of Representatives seat in the 7th District of Virginia. We invited Eric Cantor, whose secretary responded with, quote, "We can't help you this year." So, unlike WRVA and Fox News, we have gone out of our way ahead of this interview to offer opportunity for dialogue. That actually is a great segue to ask one of the questions of our listeners. Jed Proctor asked, how are you going to vote on Amendment 1 at the state level?
I'm going to vote no. Okay. I think it's a horribly written amendment. It is overbroad. It is, in my belief, writing discrimination into the Constitution. And I believe that it will have far-reaching effects that were unintended. I attended a press conference for the Commonwealth Coalition yesterday, and I spoke there, and we're talking about the effect that the amendment might have on domestic relations, domestic violence statutes, and we were talking about as a defense lawyer that, you know, you would be duty bound to, on behalf of your client, bring up a constitutional challenge to domestic assault between cohabitants that are not married, and it might have an effect on protective orders. I know that the arguments that I've heard for the amendment are that, well, even though the law prohibits marriage between anybody other than a man and a woman, that there may be some judicial activist judges that may not agree with that. I don't think that that's possible. I think that there's not a judge in the Commonwealth of Virginia that would rule against the statute. They may find it unconstitutional, and that would throw it into the appellate courts, and then that would be decided by a court other than a circuit court judge. It would be decided by the Supreme Court of Virginia or well, not the Supreme Court of Virginia, but actually by a federal court, probably, if it's a constitutional issue, and it would probably go up to the United States Supreme Court. You know, J. Harvey Wilkinson, who's on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, I don't think that anybody would call him liberal by any stretch of the imagination. He wrote a very, I thought, learned and well thought out editorial in the Richmond Times-Dispatch, stating why he was against the amendment. And I wouldn't call him a activist judge. I think that he, even by conservatives' litmus test, certainly follows the Constitution and follows the law. And so I don't think that their argument holds water. For those reasons and a number of others, I would vote no on Proposition 1 and would urge everybody else to as well.
And then reaching back briefly into an earlier part of our conversation, I know that MoveOn had a demonstration at a gasoline station in the west end of Richmond several months ago, mm-hmm. and I received an email from someone saying, well, Cantor's opponent also took money from the oil and gas industry. So you don't know anything about that?
Referring to me?
Well, the email didn't actually specify. It could have been Blanton.
I haven't received any money from oil and gas that I'm aware of. Okay. All my contributions have come from individuals. I have received a few political action committee checks, but those are from labor, from the pipe fitters, from the electrical workers, and from the Teamsters. And that's because I was endorsed by the AFL-CIO. But I've only received three checks. Other than that, all of my checks have come from individuals. So, and I don't remember any of them being from any oil companies or gas companies.
Certainly not in the order of, what did you say, 87,000? Is that what
yes,
you think you said?
Yes. I mean, I think you could safely say I've received zero from. So, no, I have not taken any money from oil and gas, nor have I received any.
Well, from what I'm seeing, it kind of looks to me like you might be what I would maybe refer to as a new kind of Democrat in spite of having been around all these years. Because, for example, I look on your website and it says Had Enough at the top.
Right.
And that's the title of Carville's book.
Really?
Yes. So you have not read Carville's book?
No, I have not.
Oh, very interesting.
I read an old book of his, like, you know, We're Right and They're Wrong.
Right. No, this is
I read
more recent
that one.
Than that one.
No, I know it's probably a lot more recent than that one.
Yeah, it's like 2 or 3 years
old. No, I haven't read that book.
I know one of the problems with Carville's book, he's got all these plans for how the Democrats are already doing XYZ and they should just do better at getting the word out and organizing amongst themselves and have staying on message, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I've heard they had enough theme at several places now over this last year, and so that's where I wondered if you had read Carville's book. So.
The had enough theme sort of came from Newt Gingrich.
Ironic, isn't it?
Yes, and you know they went to Newt Gingrich and they said, Newt, well, what do you think about the elections this year? What do you think the Democrats' chances are? And he said, you know, all the Democrats have to do is say two words, had enough. And so I thought that was great, and I went up to Alexandria and attended a rally with Jim Webb and Barack Obama, and Barack brought it up. He said that's all you need to say. And when you look at the statistics, you know, and I have a brochure, and I have that on the top of the brochure, and I say, you know, at the time they were printed, it was about 2,700 American casualties in Iraq. I'm sure that's 3,000 or more. Now, about 20,000 wounded, American wounded in Iraq. At the time, the budget deficit was $304 billion. It's a little bit less now, but, you know, you could easily change that to $8.5 trillion national debt. And that's a national debt that has almost gone up by a third since in the Bush administration. 1.5 million Katrina evacuees displaced. And Eric Cantor receiving $2.5 million in corporate contributions in the last 3 years. And so, you know, had enough? Yes, I've had more than enough. And that's really the reason that I'm running. I'm tired of business as usual in Washington. I'm tired of Eric Cantor being a rubber stamp for the Republican Party. He votes with them 98% of the time. I just think that the 7th District deserves somebody who is a thinking person, who's not controlled by these big moneyed interests, somebody who it doesn't owe anybody anything other than doing the right thing. And that's the reason why I'm running. I mean, I'm somebody who's dedicated to bringing our troops home. I don't think we need to occupy the country of Iraq in order to promote our national interests in that region. I'm dedicated to having affordable health care for all Americans. We have about 48 million Americans now who don't have any health care, who can't afford health care. And I just think that that's a crime. In the country, the richest country on the planet, everybody can't have affordable health care. I mean, we could have health care, Massachusetts-style sort of health care where everybody pays what they can pay on a sliding scale, and we could make it work. Providing a first-class education for all of our children, not just some of our children, and then the war on terror. I mean, so much money and effort has been diverted from the war on terror because of the Iraqi war. I mean, I just can't imagine what could have been done with the $300 billion we spent in Iraq had we spent it here in the United States to secure our border, protect our ports, our airports, to finish the job in Afghanistan, to stabilize that country. But we've just were focused on Iraq, and I think it's become it was a mistake, and it is become a quagmire in Iraq. Yeah, I've had enough, and I think there needs to be some real meaningful change in Washington. Again, I go back to the idea of system-wide change in Washington. I think our political system is broken. Again, it you've got to take the money and the lobbyists out of how the political process works. I mean, I'm not trying to stop the lobbyists from lobbying people, but I am trying to change the system so that their money doesn't control our legislators. It's almost human nature. If you go up there and you're a politician, you're somebody who wants to hold office, I mean, obviously you'd like to stay up there for a while. You get elected, and then, you know, as soon as you get elected, you have to turn around and start campaigning all over again because you're elected every 2 years. And if somebody from Exxon Corporation comes up to you and says, well, you know, Jim, we need your help on this bill, and you know we won't forget you, and they start giving you the contributions, the $5,000 contribution from this PAC or that PAC, and you know, it's very tempting. And you know, I think a lot of people go up there with the best of intentions, but they compromise themselves to the point where they basically lose their principles and they become corrupted. I think that's what's happened to Eric Cantor. A lot of people tell me that he was a pretty good guy when he was in the House of Delegates. They say that since he's been up in Washington, he's become very arrogant and smug. I don't know about that. I just know what people tell me. I do know that not a lot has changed because legislators tell me that when he was in the House of Delegates, he had a nickname, and his nickname was Overdog. And they go like, well, Overdog, what does that mean? And what it means is that he was never for the underdog. You know, whenever an issue arose in the House of Delegates about a big corporation, insurance corporation, he'd be the first one to leap to his feet to their defense. And, you know, he's always been for big business, and I don't have anything against corporations or business. You know, they provide a service. They provide goods and services. They are entitled to a profit. And, you know, many people who are among us obviously are stockholders, and they're entitled to making a profit. But I don't think it should be at the expense of what is right.
This is WRIR's election special interview with Jim Nachman, candidate opposite Eric Cantor for the U.S. House of Representatives seat in the 7th District of Virginia. We invited Eric Cantor, whose secretary responded with, quote, "We can't help you this year." So, unlike WRVA and Fox News, we have gone out of our way ahead of this interview to offer opportunity for dialogue.
The American people deserve an a fair deal in everything. And so I don't believe that, you know, for example, with insurance companies, that we can talk about the poor insurance companies and that we need tort reform when they're making windfall profits, as an example. The same with the oil companies. I mean, there is no, I mean, I don't understand, for instance, why oil is as high as it is, why gas is high as it is. I know it's market influences, but for example, diesel fuel is the first thing that comes off in the refining process. Why is diesel fuel more expensive than regular gas? 3 months ago, it was 20% less than regular, but now it's almost 50% more than regular. Why is that? Is it because there's more demand for diesel fuel? I don't think so. You know, if we're talking about supply and demand, then maybe that would make sense. But I think that the gas prices are being manipulated, and I think the president administration and his buddies are benefiting from it. And I think it's wrong. Eric Cantor, there's another side to all this. Not only do I not agree with his voting record, but you have to look at who he's been associating himself with. And I know people are, you know, I hear from people and they go like, well, Jim, you know, why are you saying all these things about Eric Cantor? Why don't you just talk about yourself? And I try to do both. I try to let people know about who I am and what I stand for. But I think I'm doing a disservice to the electorate unless I point out what Eric Cantor's record is and what he has done. Because, you know, I like to try and compare and contrast so that people have a choice. It's one of the reasons why I'm running. I mean, if I am campaigning and I don't mention that Eric Cantor has been associated with Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff, I think I'm doing people a disservice. You know, obviously, Eric Cantor used to be, you know, he used to talk about Tom DeLay all the time, used to be his best buddy. It is the reason why he is in his position today is because he was so close to Tom DeLay. When Tom DeLay got into trouble, he was his chief defender. And he was going like, I don't understand what the big deal is about this. You know, why are people getting all excited about this? And now after the man has been indicted and has resigned in disgrace, you don't hear about Tom DeLay anymore. Jack Abramoff and his associates gave Eric Cantor over $30,000. And why? Why would Jack Abramoff give him that kind of money? And why would Eric Cantor have 8 events at Jack Abramoff's family's restaurant in D.C., Signature's Restaurant? Well, it's because Eric Cantor, along with Mr. Blunt and Mr. Hastert, wrote a letter to the Secretary of Interior asking her to deny a gambling permit in Louisiana, a gambling permit that was being proposed by somebody who was in competition to one of Jack Abramoff's clients. What does a gambling permit in Louisiana have to do with the 7th Congressional District? I don't know. And Eric Cantor has never really answered that question. You know, when all this was brought up, Eric Cantor said, you know, we're going to give all that money back. And he donated $10,000 of that over $30,000 to the William Byrd Community Center. And he says, we're going to account for every penny of that. And we're going to get to the bottom of this. Never heard anything about it. Never heard anything more about it. He's given $10,000 back, but he's pocketed the other $20,000. That's still there. And, with this Mark Foley business, you know, I issued a press conference, not press conference, a press release, and I asked Eric Cantor, well, what did you know and when did you know it? Because there's all this talk that, you know, Hastert and other people knew about Mark Foley and these text messages or email messages years before it actually was brought to light. And Eric Cantor's response was, well, I didn't go to Congress to police my colleagues. And I thought that response was extremely arrogant. I went, what do you mean? You're part of the Republican leadership. You are the deputy majority whip of the House of Representatives. What do you mean it's not your job, not your business? I mean, you're the whip. Aren't you supposed to whip everybody in line and get everybody together? And it's not like, I mean, do we really believe that Speaker of the House Hastert and Mr. Blunt and Eric Cantor and Mark Foley, who I believe was Deputy Majority Whip himself at one time, that they don't talk and they don't know what's going on. And so he never really answered the question. And when I call up the Richmond Times Dispatch and talk to them about my second press release, admonishing Cantor for saying these things, they said, "Oh, you're just rehashing what you did before, Jim." And I go, "Well, don't you see how important it is that, you know, this man is saying that it's not his business?" When of course it absolutely is his business. If he was a backbencher, I could understand that he might have that attitude. But since he's in Republican leadership, I just think it's a totally irresponsible statement. So, you know, Eric Cantor has his ethical problems as well. I'm not exactly, you know, you can't take the moral high ground and then be associated with folks who have been indicted, like Jack Abramoff and Tom DeLay, and people have, you know, resigned. And you know, the whole question with the Foley affair is, you know, did they really know something about Foley, or is this just a big surprise? And were they trying to cover it up because, you know, they knew this seat was important to keeping the majority? And it sort of fits a pattern. You know, one of these incidents, you know, maybe you could say, well, you know, that happens. You know, some, you know, people are not perfect. They're human. They have frailties. And but, you know, when you see person after person after person who Eric Cantor associates with go down, you see a pattern there that maybe they're just more concerned about the money and the power and the position than doing what's right. And I think that goes back to my theme about how Eric Cantor and other politicians in Washington and the system has basically become corrupt.
So to rephrase it in the terms a lot of folks living around here might know, by their fruits ye shall know them, that the stockholders have more power now than the stakeholders. The people who vote have less power, despite their numbers, than the stockholders, who are ever dwindling in their concentration.
Well, not even the stockholders, because most of the stockholders are just investing in, you know, getting some stock, hoping to have a good return on their investment. Most of the stockholders who own stock in companies don't really have any input into what the company's policies are. You know, maybe a stockholder that, you know, holds hundreds of thousands of shares, but the normal person who has 100 shares, you know, of Exxon, 100 shares of Microsoft or IBM or, you know, GE or Baltimore Gas and Electric Company, they don't really have anything to do with those companies' policies. So I think that the top 1% wealthiest Americans are really sort of driving this administration and driving a lot of these representatives in Washington. And unfortunately, the middle class and the people, even the upper middle class, they're not being represented. If you look at the 7th congressional district, I think Eric Cantor is probably representing the top 1% of the district, but the other 99% are basically unrepresented, and that's a reason that I'm running. I win or lose, I want to be out there fighting for working men and women in the district, and I can't help but think of I was at the Page County Agricultural Fair, and of course I was going around talking to people and handing out brochures and introducing myself and kind of trying to engage people. And this one lady came up to me and she says, "Well, I'm a Republican." And I said, "Well," and she says, "I like what Eric Cantor is doing." I said, "Well, tell me why you're a Republican." And she couldn't really tell me. And I think that happens more often than not, that a lot of people classify themselves as Republicans, but they can't really tell you why. They'll say things like, "Well, Republicans are for low taxes." Well, you know, I'm for low taxes too. I'm not really for having to tax people more than we have to. Republicans are for this, they're for that, you know, they're sticking up for me and my family values. And I said, "Well, ma'am, you know, where do you work?" And she worked for the textile industry. And I said, "Well, do you know that Eric Cantor is not for you? I mean, I'm endorsed by the AFL-CIO. I am for all of the things that you would be interested in as a textile worker." And you know, she told me some stories about how she had been taken advantage of. And when I explained all this to her and was able to talk to her for a few minutes, she said, well, I'm voting for you.
This actually is a great segue to ask a question that's probably somewhat unique to this station and area, which is that you mentioned that when you went to the Richmond Times-Dispatch that we've never heard any follow-up on where the other $20,000 went. And the RTD said, oh, you're just rehashing it. Well, that's a point that actually I used to make what used to be a Republican statement, which is we want to create low-power FM radio stations in urban centers all over the United States to create competition so that the other points of view can get out, so that you would have a chance to have a conversation with that woman who would then realize through the Socratic method of questions that maybe she was misled or she had a different perspective that needed some more information. And so it was a huge disappointment to many progressives and conservatives across the United States that in 2000, when the FCC created the low-power FM radio service with a spacing method, I'm not going to get too technical, but a method of spacing them out that created in Richmond seven new slots. Well, then the National Association of Broadcasters, the top elements of National Public Radio,
and the National Religious Broadcasters Association
got together, went to the Republicans and 11 or I think it was 8 or 11 Democrats and said, this is terrible. We need to not let them have that spacing. They got a rider on the bill. Bill Clinton signed it. There were no Democrats on the floor of Congress saying, this is bad. There was only one person, a Republican named John McCain, who got up and said, shame on NPR, shame on the NAB. No Democrat stood up. And that's why when I see Had Enough, I'm thinking, that's a different kind of Democrat than I saw in 2000 that was like, oh, don't look over here.
No,
And you know, let me finish just a moment here. The radical right presented their viewpoints starting in the 1960s with this huge, what became a huge network of a completely alternate communication system, these religious AM radio stations. The left had nothing like it, still doesn't. If you get elected and you get your chance to vote on a bill that would put back the original spacing that would create urban LPFMs all over the world, I mean, United States, not world, will you support that? Will you get on the floor of Congress and
absolutely.
Say this is a good thing?
Yes, absolutely. I will
good.
Do that.
Because you would be the first Democrat, unfortunately, to actually get up and do
well,
that.
And you know, I can sympathize because, you know, I hear stories, you know, voters come to me and they go like, well, I heard Jimmy Barrett on WRVA and he says that Eric Carre doesn't have any opposition. And so we call WRVA and we go like, well, what's the deal? Why are you saying that? You know, we want equal time. I mean, you put out over the air that there's no opposition. And we had to complain in order to get on the air. So he's giving me 5 minutes tomorrow on the air. Just me and Jimmy Barrett, you know, back and forth. But, you know, we had to, like, jump through a lot of hoops to get him to agree to do that. The same thing with Fox TV. We understand that Eric Carre was on Fox TV, and we're getting the runaround from Fox. So it's there needs to be more competition, absolutely. And
I wish that Clinton had the kahunas to stand up for.
Yeah, I don't know why he did that. I don't know why he did that.
Because he's not really progressive. But that's a whole nother rant.
This is WRIR's election special interview with Jim Nachman, candidate opposite Eric Cantor for the U.S. House of Representatives seat in the 7th District of Virginia. We invited Eric Cantor, whose secretary responded with, quote, we can't help you this year. So, unlike WRVA and Fox News, we have gone out of our way ahead of this interview to offer opportunity for dialogue.
So, so I got that out of my system. You know, I'm big on the idea that we should not wait for anybody to save our bake. Should not wait on big church. Don't wait on big business. Don't wait on big government. Do what you can right now to make your life as you see fit. To me, a progressive state of view is our society should be that such that everyone can be who they want to be as long as they're not harming anyone else. So it's a three-part question. What are you going to do if you get elected to support that kind of enable people to be who they want? What are you going to do if you don't get elected? And what are you already doing?
Well, I'm hoping to get elected.
Sure.
I mean, I didn't, you know, one of the things that was asked of me when they were considering me for the nomination was, are you just going to be sort of a placeholder or are you going to be a real candidate? And so I pledged to the 7th District Democratic Committee that I was going to be a real candidate. So I'm in it to win. I have limited resources because of the money.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, in order to get my message out, I need money. And, you know, and
or fair media.
or fair media.
But we don't have that.
But, you know, you it's not fair in the sense that, you know, I have to spend they increase their prices around election time almost tenfold when you try and buy spots to make money off of these people who are running for office, people like me. And obviously, if I had the money, I would be better able to carry my message to the people. This is also one of the problems about fighting an incumbent like Eric Cantor. And it is what it is. I'm doing the best I can do with what I have. And you know, I hear the complaints from people. You know, I see your signs, but there should be more. And you know, are you going to have a TV ad? And how come you're not on the radio? And I say, well, you know, it costs money. And you know, there's many facets of the campaign. It's like starting a business. I have not stopped practicing law. I'm still practicing law, but I'm doing like two full-time jobs.
Yeah.
And I have a staff that, of course, deserves to be paid because they're working hard. I put a lot of money into this campaign myself, both real money and in-kind money. And we're doing a lot of phone banking, both volunteer phone banking and professional phone banking, because we thought that that was something that would reach real voters, people who are likely to vote, and we could bring the message to them better that way than using a scattergun approach on TV. If I had millions of dollars, I'd be doing both. But it is what it is, and I'm very, very gratified at the amount of support that I've received. I know over 500 to 600 contributors contribute to my campaign in a short period of time. It's the grassroots people who are supporting me. And I think there's a lot of people, there's a wave of dissatisfaction throughout the country, throughout the 7th Congressional District. And it's going to, the results of this election is going to depend on who comes out and votes. Because, I mean, just look at it this way. In a non-presidential year like this year, about 48%, I predict, of the registered voters in the 7th Congressional District are going to come out and vote. And the 7th Congressional District is one of the best voting congressional districts, if not the best one, in the whole Commonwealth, at 48%. Which means if I can get 24% of the people who are coming out to vote plus one, then I'm going to win. But I know you asked me, what are you going to do if you don't win?
I ask you all three, actually. What are you going to do to enable people to be who they want to be?
I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing. I mean, I've been involved in the political process. I've been the chair of the Richmond Democrat Committee, and I'm trying to get people involved in the political process, trying to get them involved in issues. I'm trying to get people to think and not just react, to do something, you know, to give back to the community. I'm going to continue to do that. I mean, I do that in my professional life. You know, I help people every single day by representing them in court. I do a lot of pro bono work. You know, sometimes I'll take a case and I won't, you know, charge people the full amount. Sometimes I'll do it for free. You know, I do pro bono work, representing people, mostly women who are seeking protective orders, who need them, and, people who can't afford a lawyer.
Yeah.
And so, I try to do my part, and lawyers are ethically bound to do that. If they're doing what they're supposed to do. And I try to do that also, you know, for the community as being involved in my Masonic Lodge and being involved in the Richmond City Democrat Committee and Democratic politics. I'm going to continue this. And you know, if I'm not successful this time, I might run again for this office or another office. I'm not really foreclosing anything.
Well, so now that we've created this wonderful training ground for terrorists, how can we pull out, having in effect impregnated the woman, so to speak, by having been there? Now what? I mean, you can't undo it. So what do we do?
I don't think all is lost in Iraq. I think the administration is somewhat correct in saying that there are a lot of good people in Iraq who want to have a stable country, who want to raise their children and not bring them up in hatred.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that we have to extricate ourselves from Iraq in a way that gives the Iraqi people a chance to take hold of their country. But I don't think that that is just a limitless sort of a plan in the sense of time. We have to, and I know the Republicans are going, oh, we don't think that we should set an artificial timetable. And I go like, well, what's the difference between a regular timetable and an artificial timetable? I don't really get that. You know, if you're thinking about getting out at some point in time, you have to have some plan or some timetable. Obviously, it's sort of implied. Think that there needs to be some plan to disengage at some point in time. And I think that it should be sooner rather than later because, you know, we have to not let the Republicans control the agenda on this war, on this occupation. We need to start asking the questions and constantly ask the question, like, what is the mission and how long is the mission going to take? Now Eric Cantor and folks like him will tell you that the mission is to create a democratic republic in Iraq or to fight the war on terror. Iraq has now become the sort of part of the greater war on terror, if not the focus of the war on terror. I don't really believe either one of those. I don't believe that we're ever going to be successful in creating a democratic republic in Iraq, and I think we all allow the Iraqi people to decide what kind of government they want, whether it's a parliamentary form of government or whatever. I mean, I don't think that we can dictate to them what type of government they're going to have. They are the ones that are going to decide the destiny of their country. And maybe some of the neighboring states will help them with that as well, maybe to their detriment. I don't know. But I don't think that we can police the world. And as far as the war on terror is concerned, I mean, it didn't start out this war in Iraq being about the war on terror, but it's sort of become the war on terror because we're sort of a lightning rod. You know, and as a result, I think we have made the world and our country less safe rather than more safe. I mean, I think we've done a lot of good things, but I don't think it's enough. I mean, the 911 Commission's recommendations have not been fully implemented, and I think they need to be. And I think that the money that's being spent in Iraq is taking us away from implementing those recommendations. I mean, these containers that come in the ships into our ports, I mean, they're being checked, but not all of them are being checked.
Right.
I mean, and you know, you hear all these scenarios that somebody could, you know, smuggle in a dirty bomb in one of these containers. It wouldn't be that hard. That scares me to death. I think if we spent the money more wisely in implementing those recommendations of the 911 Commission, we'd be a lot safer. Granted, I know we have national interests in the Middle East and probably in Iraq. But again, as I said before, we don't need to occupy the whole country to promote those interests. I mean, we are dependent in a large sense on foreign oil, and so is Europe. And I know the reason we're in Iraq is, you know, I know everybody said when the war started, it's about the oil, it's about Iraqi oil. And I go, no, it's not about Iraqi oil. It's about Saudi Arabian and Persian Gulf oil. The Straits of Hormuz is probably the most strategic place on the planet. It is where a major proportion of our foreign oil is coming from. There's no coincidence that we had troops in Saudi Arabia, and when we invaded Iraq, we eventually withdrew our troops from Saudi Arabia because we no longer need them there to protect the Straits of Hormuz and Persian Gulf oil. And that's why we're in Iraq, is to protect that oil and sort of act as a strategically as a counter to Iran. We sort of created this problem. I mean, people have to understand the history and the perspective of the region. You know, if you remember, the Shah fell and the Ayatollah Khomeini took over, and there was a large war between Iraq and Iran and Saddam Hussein versus the Ayatollah. And we changed the balance of power in that war because we backed Saddam Hussein, and Saddam Hussein bought chemical weapons with the money that we gave him, and it changed the balance of power in the war. And so, Saddam was our man, and then when he stopped playing ball with us, that's when we had the problem. So we kind of created this monster. Our Middle Eastern policy is not very comprehensive. You know, I think the old adage of keeping your friends close but your enemies closer, there's something to be said for that. I think that we should be talking to some of these regimes in the Middle East, even though they're horrible regimes. I think we need to know what they're up to. We need to try and make friends. And I know we've been trying to do this with more moderate people in the Middle East. Our policy is just disjointed. It's not very comprehensive. It's something that needs to be overhauled. And we don't really need to occupy the entire country in order to protect the oil fields.
Well, it seems to me that you know, the sins of the fathers are visited upon the sons. Kermit Roosevelt overthrew Mossadegh with CIA funds in the early 50s. Mossadegh was a moderate Muslim. So we have destroyed the moderate Muslims to create profit flow.
Right.
You know, so we basically cash in the blood of the poor for the profit of the pharaoh, so to speak, to put it in Virginia speak, I guess, for some areas. So, you know, when I say what can we do to make sure that we can be the people we want, I'm also thinking that personally, for example, previous to the passage a few weeks ago of the Military Commissions Act, that I was kind of willing to play along. But now that they've passed that, I see that they're willing to dramatically destroy the balance started by the founders of the U.S. Constitution.
Right.
For raw power grabs.
We are talking about that, we lawyers, about just the ability of the president to declare anybody an enemy combatant.
The way I'm
understanding,
and
to suspend habeas corpus so that you can be locked up and you can't even get a hearing to, and you know, people say to prove your innocence, but in our judicial system, last time I checked, you're presumed to be innocent until proven guilty by a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, and I have here from the Center for Constitutional Rights, they're saying that U.S. citizens deemed to have, quote, materially supported hostilities against the United States could be held as enemy combatants as well, without charge.
That's right.
So that means that if I buy my oil from Citgo, and they're owned by Venezuela, right, and Venezuela is declared an enemy of the United States, then it's a stretch. I agree.
Well,
given the stretches we've already seen.
If you're talking to them, and of course they can wiretap you and listen to what you're saying, even though you're an American citizen, they can lock you up. And not only that, I think the president can also decide what cruel and unusual punishment is these days.
Yeah. So it's a good thing I grew up in Florida. The waterboarding won't be so bad.
I guess so.
So what are you going to do about the MCA?
I don't know. I think we need to have good legislators up there who will overturn this.
What happens if you don't win? How can we, at this level, given the voting irregularities we're already seeing in Chesterfield?
Well, I guess somebody will have to be arrested, and there'll have to be a test case.
But they can't. We won't know they're arrested.
Well, at some point, somebody's going to find out, hopefully, about somebody who was arrested wrongfully, and they'll have to bring it to court, and hopefully the courts will stand up to
that?
The president.
But, I'm not a lawyer, so...
Because the other part is... Well, I mean, it's you know, you can bring you can bring a writ of habeas corpus, and then of course you have to find a judge who will say that the law is unconstitutional. Of course, by the time it gets to the court and the Supreme Court actually hears it, the person would have been in jail for probably a couple of years.
Yeah, well, here's a note from alternate.org, a Gonzalez quote. This is from the New York Times. Quote, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, who is defending President Bush's anti-terrorism tactics in multiple court battles, said Friday, this last week, I think, that federal judges should not substitute their personal views for the president's judgments in wartime.
Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's striking right at the balance of power between the three so-called equal branches of government.
Not anymore.
And you know, it is the judicial branch that is to interpret what the laws mean, and not the executive branch. You know, the president wasn't complaining that the Supreme Court decided the election for him a number of years ago, was he?
No, he didn't.
Right. So if they can decide that, then they can decide this. Somebody who is independent of the legislative and the executive branch has got to be the one to interpret our laws. And that, under our form of government, as the founding fathers saw it, is the judicial branch.
What if there's enough hanky-panky in this next election, as in the last several, that everybody's in doubt?
Well, what worries me is the administration and the Republicans being controlled and basically stacking all the courts so that they only put people who agree with them into those judicial positions.
Right. So what do we do?
we gotta elect other people. And for nothing else, to vote Democratic this time, for nothing else, do it because it'll achieve a balance of power. So that, even if you don't like Democrats, at least vote them in. At least they have a different view than the Republicans. And, the Republicans, if you give them absolute power and, you know, control over the executive and legislative and judicial branches, then that's basically, you're going to get one view. It's not like the Republican Party is a diverse party, like they're a big tent. The Democrats are very diverse, and that's one of our strengths and one of our weaknesses. Getting Democrats together is very difficult. Principles of the Democratic Party are great. You need to elect Democrats this time to counter Bush and this sort of absolute power that he's trying to exercise.
This is WRIR's election special interview with Jim Nachman, candidate opposite Eric Cantor for the U.S. House of Representatives seat in the 7th District of Virginia. We invited Eric Cantor, whose secretary responded with, quote, "We can't help you this year." So, unlike WRVA and Fox News, we have gone out of our way ahead of this interview to offer opportunity for dialogue.